Off the Record was a series of chats for me to talk to people who I've had the pleasure, privilege, and enjoyment of working with. I think I've looked into the eyes of a great actor twice in my career. Once was with Judi Dench doing a stage play. And I thought perhaps that's going to be a one-off moment. And then in July of this year, I walked into a room in Berkeley Castle and I met my guest today and worked with him. And truly again, I thought, I'm looking into the eyes of a great actor. And that person is here today, and it's brilliant to be able to say hello to Mark Rylance.
Thank you, Paul. That was really sweet of you.
Did you like that? Did you like that notice?
Did I write that? No, but it reminds me that I had the similar kind of language come across my desk about this program, and for a day I said I'm not going to do it, and it makes you think how these contracts are so ominous, aren't they, and frightening. the language of them, and the fact that you have no consent and you give your image and your stories for use worldwide, and they've become very ominous contracts, particularly for television and film. You can feel very small in the face of it, can't you? I don't normally do this kind of thing, but my wife reminded me how much I've enjoyed watching interviews with a man called Dick Cavett, who was an American interviewer in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s, and he interviewed a lot of wonderful actors and actresses, Bette Davis, Katharine Hepburn, Robert Mitchum was a favorite of mine. And if they hadn't given those interviews, I wouldn't have been able to see what they thought about film acting. I don't remember any theater actors being interviewed. It was mostly film acting. But you can learn a lot from them. So I thought, well, maybe this will be helpful in some way. So I would encourage you to ask me questions about our profession and the things that frighten you or challenge you or the things that you love about it in relation to my work, rather than it just be about my personality, which will go away, whatever there is of it anyway. But our craft will carry on, I'm sure, as long as people are alive. So the craft is what interests me today. Anyway, but don't. If you want to ask me what socks I like, go ahead. You can ask that too.
All right. So we'll come over to you in a little while, and please get your questions ready. I'm sure there'll be loads. I'm going to ask a really boring question to start. It's where I like to start. Can you remember? Can you identify the moment where it clicked in your brain? That's the beginning of the journey to where you are now. Most actors can say, you know, oh, I think it was when I did, or. And I wondered if there's a moment for you that you think that's where it started. Mm.
Well, I enjoyed acting before I knew there was such a thing as acting or a thing such as theatre, and that I enjoyed as a very young boy pretending to be other people than who I was. And I got most of my characters and scripts from television shows. In those days, they were shows like Star Trek and The Wild Wild West, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, these kind of Land of the Giants was a good one, and they gave you almost like a commedia script. They gave you, you know, Scotty, he behaved in a certain way when the engine was too hot, and Spock was never emotional, and Kirk was always, you know, fancying someone and getting something was happening there. And so it was just my way of playing and passing the time and gathering friends, I suppose. It was a natural thing to me, but it was a private thing. It wasn't something we ever did for people to watch or comment on. It was only for our enjoyment. And there's still a part of me, I can hear that little part of me speaking up now, that feels completely betrayed by the fact that I now act in front of people and make a living. That's a kind of betrayal. It's an odd state. But so that went on for a long time. Maybe about age 14 or 15, the seminal moment that comes to me is a Friday evening in a city in America called Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is in the north, very cold. And the thing you do on a Friday evening when you're at school at 15 is you go to the hockey game, which is outdoors at an ice rink, and all the good the people play it really well. I played it, but I didn't play it well enough. They're playing some team of mustached bruisers from even further north who've come down. And you go along, and hopefully someone brings a bottle of whiskey or something, and you get very drunk, and you watch the game and bang on the plastic and shout. And then there was the whole thing also of girls and whether you're going steady with someone and all that kind of, all that stuff. And I'm walking up the hill on my own towards this hockey rink, and I pass by a building. I can see it on my left. It's very dark, as it is now early in the evening. It's maybe December, January, cold. And there's a little light. That sounds like the beginning of a Rocky Horror Picture Show song. There is a little light in this old building. And I realize that there are some of the boys and the girls who are involved in the theater department are in there building the set. And they're working over the weekend to build the set. And I remember stopping and thinking, I really am not looking forward to going to this hockey game and getting drunk and then seeing which girls we can pick up. And it just was all felt very, very foreign to me or uncomfortable to me. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just go in there and see if they'll let me in. I was much younger than they were to help build the set. And that was, I remember feeling at the time that it was an important decision, though it seems a small one now. But I did go into the theater, knocked on the door. They welcomed me in like I was a son or something into the family of it. And for quite a while, I just carried the rubbish bins from the theater right through the school to the boiler room and emptied them. But they were playing Bob Dylan records, and they were telling interesting stories. They were all 18, 17, 18. I was 14, 15. And really, that's how I got involved, building sets, doing lighting, and then gradually getting involved in acting, which I was too shy to do at first. So that's a long answer, but that's a turning point for me.
That's a lovely story. You caught up once, I think, you caught up with, was it Olivier's Richard III on telly and watched it back to back or something?
There was theatre in Milwaukee. There was a repertory theatre which I used to go and usher at, and there was a little experimental theatre called Theatre X. I'm going to sit on the chair because it's a bit low. Theatre X. And then we made a lot of theatre in high school. I was very involved in a very active theatre department, luckily, and we did classical plays, Hamlet and Medea, and musicals. It being America, I did a number of musicals when I was younger. But there was one occasion, that's when I came back, and there was a channel in America called PBS, Public Broadcasting Services, I guess it means. And it was on the, maybe it was a Sunday afternoon, but Olivier's Richard III was playing. And I remember, it was near the beginning, but I think I'd missed the beginning, but I got so caught up with it by the theatricality of it. And they played it again afterwards. They did a dub, they played it twice that day. And I remember just sitting and watching it again and being very, very fascinated by it. Yeah, loving it.
And you came back from America, your whole family came back, so that you trained over here?
My family didn't come back initially. I came back age 18.
Okay.
I got a place in Toronto, which I think there's some people from RADA here today.
Give us a wave if you're from... What do you call an old RADian? RADian? Are you RADians or...?
I don't know.
RADites? I don't know. Anyway, thank you for coming along. So RADA.
Yeah.
Can you remember what your audition speech was for RADA?
Yes, I do. I Hamlet has always been my audition speech. I'd played Hamlet at 16. I didn't play it. I avoided all the other parts in Shakespeare and began with Hamlet. So I knew it. I knew it. And I don't. It just made sense to me. But there's a speech in it that begins, "Now I am alone. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I." And that speech got me into RADA. It got me into the Citizens Theatre, which was my first job. It got me into the RSC, though I did it in cod Japanese to get into the RSC. It still got me into the RSC.
What does it sound like in cod Japanese?
Oh, it's like...
Not
very good. Not very. I was better at cod Japanese when I was younger. I was a great lover of Toshiro Mifune. Have you seen his films, the Kurosawa films of Toshiro Mifune? And I'll come back to Radha, but I was at an audition and I arrived too early, as you do sometimes, and I could hear the other people auditioning through the door. Have you had that? And it's not a good thing to it really isn't. And the whole thing just seemed utterly, I just felt it wasn't somewhere I wanted to be, and it just seemed utterly, I don't know, uncomfortable, and I just felt so much pain for the people who were in there having to audition, and I could feel the nervous energy and having people arrive and go in, and so I thought, no, this isn't for me, it really isn't, and I got up and left. And I was walking down the street, I thought, well, if it's so silly and unimportant, then why are you walking away from it? Why is it, you're frightened, aren't you? That's why you're walking away. If it means nothing, if this has all been made too important and it means nothing, then you should go back and use it. Use the occasion for something for yourself rather than walk away from it. And so that's rather unfortunate thought because I was looking forward to going home. But I thought I had a point. So I turned around and thought, well, I'll see if I can express all the thoughts of that speech, but think them all, but say it in Japanese, cod Japanese. And it was Adrian Noble I was auditioning for. Yeah. And so I went in, and without saying what I was going to do, I just treated this as an exercise for myself, whether I could do this. And I made it maybe two-thirds of the way through the speech and then got lost, and then I think found the last bit. And he sat very patiently watching me and said, yes, that, he said, of course, the Japanese take longer to say something than we do. I'm not sure if that's true, but that's what he thought. And he said, now you have to deliver and do it, you know, in English for me. And so I did. And I suppose that led, it didn't lead immediately to getting into the RSC, but it led to him asking them to see me for a season. But it was a good lesson to me to think of making sure that auditions, whether you get the job or not, are something for yourself, that you get something out of it yourself that isn't dependent on whether they like what you're doing or you get the job. And that did stick with me, and I from that time on I tried to make sure that my audition was a little play, that it was a little it was a play that I was, whether I got the job or not, I would entertain them. It would have a beginning, a middle, and the end, and I would judge it afterwards myself on whether what it was like as a little play, a little performance of something, rather than, because I thought, if we'd on Wolf Hall come out and acted that scene you talked about in order to impress Peter Kosminski that we were good enough actors to be in another film of his, we wouldn't have done a good job. So that urge to impress people that you're a good actor has to be woven into the fabric of what you're doing. Otherwise, I'm not sure it will be good acting. It may be impressive acting, but that wouldn't be the way that you would approach a scene a couple of weeks into a run of a play or a scene in a shoot, would it be? You'd be just playing the needs of the character. So I think that was it. I tried to make sure that I had a little play where I could do the needs of the character rather than the needs of me as a professional actor needing money to pay my bills or to move my career forward or anything like that.
It's funny, isn't it, that auditions are sometimes about showing that acting, and actually when we do watch great acting and good acting, we're not aware of it.
Well, yeah.
We're just totally wrapped up.
Well, yeah. Which is a worrying thing about auditions now. I was talking to someone who was auditioning the other day for a film or television show, and she was reading with a secretary in the casting office. Right, so that's fine, but that secretary is not trained as an actor to play an objective back, to push you or challenge you, or indeed to see that maybe I'll wait, I won't say my line, I'll give I'll give you a chance to think and for the camera to see you uncertain before I play my line. All those things that we do as fellow actors to each other. So it means that, it means to some degree that the person auditioning had to ignore what the way that the lines were being played to them, which is the first thing you're taught in training, isn't it? That you must not do. You must listen and be open and be empty and receive and pass the ball. So my concern about it is that, does that mean that people who are getting jobs in film and television, if they're auditioning that way, are people who just manufacture a performance in a little cocoon, a vessel that isn't actually interacting with the other people? And when you marry that with some of the film techniques we were even talking about back here, of directors who don't know about acting, and therefore they're going to put together performances that are not really ever connected. That's a little bit of a problem for drama on television, I think.
Are there things that you did learn at RADA that are still part of your working method today that stayed with you?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Attention to one's. For a quick example, the difference between a gesture that has no imagination going through it. So I'm trying not to put any imagination through this gesture at the moment. It's just a physical gesture. It has no need in it. It has no energy moving through it, compared to a gesture that has a need. And I'm not, so I can make up a need of, look at the beautiful architecture outside that window. There's a need now in the arm, but it's also physically about thinking that the arm has, there's an imaginative energy that goes beyond that gesture. This is just really a form it's the imagination in the gesture that's important. Likewise, there's an imagination in sound that goes beyond the audible sound. The imagination goes into the silence. The sound is still affecting us after we can't hear it with our ears. So something like that I was initially taught at RADA by a very good movement teacher, Tessa Marwick, who taught Alexander, but would just her class, actually, she didn't speak. We would just come into the classroom, and then she would start to move, and you'd realize, well, I suppose we're meant to follow her and copy her. And for an hour, we would just dance and move. And I think that was very, very useful. I learned a little bit more about voice after RADA, I have to confess. I had lovely voice teachers at RADA, but there was a lot more for me to learn than I learned at RADA. But then most I learned about working with different directors, how different directors worked. And a wonderful director called Philip Headley, I remember, came and taught me objectives and actions. And each director had different things. But we were specifically introduced to many different directors, and we were encouraged by the head of RADA that we had to learn to be true to our own craft, like a builder on a building site with different architects, no matter what the architect or the director had in mind. That how could we still be true and do our job in different conditions? I didn't learn much about television or film at that time. Did you have training in television or film at that time?
No, not a lot, and I don't think a lot of it. I think the training, it would seem to me from my knowledge of talking to graduates these days, is that it's still primarily theatre-based. Yeah. And, of course, it's a massive investment these days now. I mean, in other fields as well, in university and degrees. But to be an actor now, it's £27,000 worth of fees and investment. And perhaps nowadays young people have to think about other routes of realising their ambitions. Do you think it's worth training? Do you think it's worth that investment?
I think it's an individual choice. I'm working with Tom Hanks at the moment, and he's lovely. I don't think he ever went to a training academy. I haven't asked him, but he's talked more about doing a repertory season like we used to do.
Yeah.
But he's just a natural. My impression of him is he's just a natural actor. He's an instinctive actor. So I don't know that he needed to train. I don't think it would have hurt him. I think some. I mean, I don't know that it's. I think it can be negative for some people. I remember it being quite a hothouse of, it was quite, there was a lot to learn about really getting on with people, getting on with other people who, when you're thrown together very quickly, as one is when one works as an actor, how do you quickly develop what the different needs of the people around you are and learn to work together very intimately and codependently with people in a short way. So Radha taught a lot of that. You also get, the nice thing about drama school, if it's well organized, is you get to do many different plays, don't you? Many different types of parts. And if their casting is clever and inventive, you play old people, strong people, weak people, all kinds of different people. And so you learn more than perhaps you will if you just enter the profession and learn how to behave. I remember an actor at the Globe once speaking that he felt most of the acting on television wasn't acting, it was just behaving naturally, which is an important part of acting, but there's other things than just behaving naturally too. So you get into a community at RADA, don't you, at other schools. You meet a lot of... I'm working in January with a director who I first worked with while I was at RADA, and I've kept contact with a lot of people who I worked with there. So I think it's a good thing, but I don't think it's necessary for everyone. And I think some people it may not be so helpful for. Mm-hmm. Rupert Everett, for example, to pick someone who I worked with early on at the Citizens Theatre. Now, he got thrown out of Central, and he was very proud of it, that he'd been thrown out of Central. And indeed, I don't think Central was something that Rupert Everett needed for where he was going to go and what he was going to do, because his own... He sensed very early on that he had this very unique, wild character and that that was going to be interesting. So he uses himself, which we all do, but he just was savvy enough and ambitious enough. I don't think you would mind me saying that he was very ambitious to become well known for who he was. And so I don't know that... I don't know that he... For me, the realization that I'd come into the profession to be part of a community, to be part of a family, that was an important thing to realize for me, that was the bottom line. If I had that, I was happy. It wasn't really to do with other things than that. And for a long time, a lot of people, agents and other people and myself, convinced me that it was to do with other things. But actually, that was what made me happy. It could be a very bad play, but if it was a good group of people and we were enjoying it, then that was still all right. It's nicer when it was a good play and a good production.
But you like all that, don't you? You're a very good company leader, and even in television, which it doesn't happen normally. You don't have a company feel on something in television. People pop in and out, but you are at the Globe, people both as director and as leading actor, you're very caring for your companies and you want that feel to come back into the work. And also when we were, you know, when we were filming in the summer, you were very particular about everyone.
Yeah.
And that's a sort of theatre thing, isn't it, really, that you've...
Maybe it is. I haven't done enough film or television to know. But I've witnessed different types of leadership. You all will have witnessed different types and been part of different types of leadership. And it, you can't avoid it that if you're the lead actor, you have more influence over the working conditions than the actors who are in any other role. Partly because they will defer to you, the other actors. They'll feel that it isn't their place to say something. Partly also that you're the one that maybe is... not so expendable, or you can be maybe slightly more confident that if you do make a point or appear to be critical or complaining or demanding, you hopefully won't lose work. Whereas for a lot of actors, there's a concern that I don't want this director not to hire me again or to think that I'm demanding or complaining. Or I mean, and of course you have to find ways, don't you, of asking for what you need without it being a demand or a complaint. Or us and them. You have to learn how to break down that us and them thing that arises all the time if you're not careful. So I do think there's a responsibility when you get to a place of being a lead artist, a lead actor in a job, to look around not just for yourself, but for what's happening to the other people. Because you will be treated very differently That's the other thing. You'll be treated very specially and differently than the other people. So you have to watch out for that. Make sure it isn't too unequal. Or it means that people aren't... I don't know. I just feel like there's greater things that happen that are beyond the powers of each of us when we all work together. That includes the audience. That includes your attitude, or my attitude, as I say, to the audience. Mm-hmm. And breaking down an us and them idea of the audience. But bringing them into the circle too, and treating them as creative artists on an evening, not just because they're paying, mm-hmm. but because they're innocent of what's about to happen. So they're almost the most valuable creative artist in the room, in that they want it to happen, and they're innocent of what's going to happen. So to hold them out, or just try to awe them or impress them, is, I think, wasting that energy. But to find a way of bringing that energy into the experience by paying attention and imagining where they are. I notice that very much in Peter Kosminski's work and in Spielberg's work now, that those two directors are constantly thinking about where the audience's imagination is. Excuse me. I hope that wasn't too loud. I should really have covered this. So I think that imagining where other people are is a very important mm-hmm. thing. So yes, I do try and... Sorry, I've got a sneezing.
You all right?
Yeah.
Good.
I do try and think wider than just my own needs. It's interesting, actually, to be now in a film with Tom Hanks. Even with Damian Lewis, too, and think, well, I'm not quite the lead actor here. Certainly with Tom Hanks, I'm not the lead actor. So my role is different, and I relax and think, well, I don't have to think in the same way as he does as the lead actor. With Damien is a more famous actor who's playing King Henry VIII in Thomas Cromwell in Wolf Hall.
I think when you see it, you'll go for Thomas Cromwell.
Yeah.
Won't you?
Yeah. I'm clearly the one that's in every scene. So here's a little story. So when Damien was I was cast first, and when Damien was cast as Henry VIII, I said to Peter Kosminski, I'd like to send a card to Damien to say how thrilled I am that he's on board playing in Henry VIII. And Peter said, I'm not sure that's the right thing to do. And I said, why? And he said, well, I think because Damien's playing Henry VIII, and Damien has a strong sense of himself, and we need him to have the strong sense of himself, that's slightly you as the saying, you know, glad to have you on board. You have to be really careful about being patronizing. And we actually need Damien to be the most powerful person on the set at any moment. So it wasn't really my place, Peter was right, to welcome Damien on board. It wasn't right for Cromwell and Henry VIII, and it maybe wasn't right for Mark Rylance and Damien Lewis. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So, all those subtleties, you can get very annoyed by them, or you can just think, well, that's... Actually, we need an actor who's going to be a king.
Yeah.
And so all those things are very interesting.
Well, I'm sure we've got a room full brimming of questions.
Yeah, and you see, I give terrible long answers.
No, it's great. It's great, because I don't have to do any work. You're fantastic and very funny, and there's a room full of people. I am going to ask you, though, just before we hand over, so get your hands ready to come up, get ready to be exploited. Where did the cleavage come from?
The cleavage?
Because in all the roles you've played, and most recently when you were on Broadway winning another Tony with Twelfth Night, there was a constant battle going on between you and, I think, Paul Shahidi Geeve, who played Maria, about these amazing cleavages you managed to produce as Olivia. And where do you begin, you know?
I've studied cleavage for a long time. Yes, it's been a fascinating course of study. No, Paul Shahidi, whose name is Geeve, and so became known as Geevage, was the term that we developed for it. It really just, I mean, it comes from the corsets, you know, it comes from just squeezing yourself. Wonder corsets, I think they're called. But it's funny that the because we did three productions with all female casts at the Globe, and now I'm thrilled that Harriet and that group of women are carrying on doing all-female productions. I think that's terrific. And then because of the original practices that the Globe was about, we did a number of all-male productions. The all-male productions, for some reason, it becomes fascinating to change ourselves physically. That we were fascinated by changing ourselves physically with wigs and with corsets and, as you say, with creating some kind of cleavage, thinking a lot about opening our arms like this as men, really using this more vulnerable side of our arms, which is something that women do a little bit more than men do. And just the whole movement, the physical movement, the physical nature of being a woman, our voices as well. When the women played men, therefore, as we'd done it a bit before, I encouraged them along that path, and even in one production of Taming of the Shrew, they wore mustaches and beards. And it was much more interesting. So if I think of Janet McTeer playing Petruchio, which was a marvelous performance of Petruchio, she didn't change her physical nature at all. I mean, she changed her walk and did some kind of more, put her hips forward and stuff like that. But it was more the psychological thing of having a woman's psyche playing a man's psyche. I think there was a different way that women play men than men play women, is what I'm struggling to say. That it was not so physical. It was more to do with, it was wonderful to have a woman's sensibility, a woman's way of thinking and feeling inside a man's character. That was the revelation of it. And I think that's why it's nice here with the work that Harriet and, what's the director's name? Wonderful, she did Mamma Mia.
Phyllida.
Phyllida's leading that work. That they've decided to set it in a prison, which is a wonderful idea, that the women are imprisoned in this kind of masculine world, which is certainly the condition of the women for the moment in the world. There are more women enslaved at the moment, I read the other day, than there were Africans during the height of the African slave trade. I mean, really enslaved, in basements, in chains, in whatever. It is a prison situation. Very, very worrying. So she set that, but they don't pretend to be men outright, do they? They're women in a prison then acting men. I think it's a very good step. I think the single gender theatre, whether it's male or female, is a very exciting form of theatre, and certainly good at balancing the part different. The fact that there are so many more parts for men than women, and yet there are just as many talented actresses as actors. Of course, there are. Maybe more.
Okay. Right. It's that moment where we go, any questions? And there's normally a quick hiatus, but there isn't today. And that hand went straight up. Could we just ask that you might stand up so we could exploit you fully? Brilliant.
Hi, Mark. I had a question about Wolf Hall and filming that. I've read the books, and it strikes me there's a lot of stuff which is unsaid about Cromwell. There's a lot of uncertainty about his character, about why he does things. And if you're working as an actor with objectives and actions and trying to be really specific with what you need and want in each scene, how did you go about marrying that with what you sort of got of the character from the books, while also perhaps preserving some of that uncertainty in the finished film as well? I don't know what it's like, but yeah. That's a convoluted question.
Yeah, good question. Very good question. Uncertainty is the end of your question is a general point, which I think is very important. Uncertainty in drama. I've sometimes seen great plays like King Lear or fantastic plays where all the characters must feel incredibly uncertain and lost in these stories. And it's all been acted very well, but I felt like nothing has happened at the end. I thought, wait a minute, I just sat for 3 hours through King Lear, but I'm not sure anything really happened. And my theory about that is that they made decisions about every moment, and even the uncertain things were acted uncertain. that no one actually really felt confused or didn't know what to say or couldn't find the right word to say. Never. Even that line, never, 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 never. Does he know he's going to say never five times when he's holding his dead daughter? Does he know what he's going to say? There's so much passion and emotion sometimes, but actually, and acting, but actually sometimes I just want confusion. You know how when you act with very little children, sometimes they're so wonderful because they just look, they really don't know what's going to happen next, but they're not frightened about it because their whole life is like that anyway. So I think uncertainty is a really key thing to say to yourself before the camera rolls or before you go on stage. I don't know what's going to happen next. I used to do it with Hamlet, coming out to say to be or not to be. That's a very, very difficult moment to be uncertain about. But to really come out uncertain onto the stage and not really know what to say or what's going on, because all the different things you are experiencing, you've had a ghost come and tell you your dad has been murdered. What the hell do you do with that? To be or not to be, that's the question. So to convince yourself that you haven't got the rest of a speech to say, all you've got is that. All you've got is uncertainty. And then rather than it being a pre-cooked dish before, but to come out and find in that moment to be or not to be, that's the question. With a kind of implicit unspoken, isn't it? Do you agree? Do you not agree? You haven't said anything. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows, and then you're into the landscape of finding things. So that thing of uncertainty, I think, is to really try and be uncertain. Now, when you have a famous speech like that, or those are hard moments, but they help to combat the nerves of it. But uncertainty is a very important thing. Now, then with Cromwell, you have a couple of things that are complicated in that you have Hilary Mantel very strongly in my memory of the book saying, this is a man who has only one expression, which is a kind of incredulous, like, kind of Robert Mitchum type. Who does he think he is? Or what, Robert Mitchum to Marilyn Monroe, if you run into that river, you're going to break your leg. That a kind of askance thing. And then against that, so it has no other expressions than that. And against that, you have all these internal thoughts that he's thinking, which is the most interesting thing of the book. And you're not going to have, the film we've made does not have voiceovers. It doesn't have me turning like Michael Caine and saying, hello. Oh, hello. My name is Mahatma Gandhi. It was a game we used to play. Did I tell you that on the set? It's a game we used to play. Because I think he's a wonderful actor, Michael Caine. But have you read his book about screen acting? It's a very good book. It really has a lot of very handy stuff in it. But there's one little chapter about dialect. And to my knowledge, Michael Caine never changes his dialect. But he speaks quite, that dialects are important. So Sean Foley and I used to play this game. And he was always the same, so the camera would come. He'd be doing something, maybe in this case he's writing something. And then he'd see the camera, he'd go, oh, hello. This isn't a film. My name is Edna St. Vincent Millay. And it would be him playing Edna St. Vincent Millay. But it would always be the same. Oh, and I hope if he hears this, that I do really reckon him as an actor. I think he's wonderful. I think whenever we write books about acting, we're inevitably going to say funny things.
Absolutely.
But I steered off the question about Wolf Hall. So it's difficult. No expression, yet all these inside thoughts, and no Michael Caine speech, direct address to the camera. So I haven't seen the film yet, so I'm yet to see whether it works or not. I tried when I was watching things that we were filming that obviously came from the book, I would read and try, not memorize word for word, but I would think this is the pattern that Hillary has written for him to be thinking, and I would try to generally follow that pattern and think what he was thinking. And it was surprising. I don't know if the audiences will see it, but with a director like Peter Kosminski, it was really surprising to me how much he would come to me afterwards and say, I saw you think that. And I've thought that I was really giving a very blank expression. But maybe I was, but the camera can pick... It is incredible what the camera can pick up. It really is remarkable. And I'm still learning to be more confident, not to express myself, but just to actually discover and think things and let that be. I think it's true in the theater too. It's surprising how much an audience picks up without you pushing it on them.
Yeah.
And it's still, and will be to my dying day, I expect, something I'll learn about, a confidence to just be in the story and to be enough. But I know I'm already seeing certain pictures of Thomas Cromwell and feeling, I look too sad, or I'm showing too much. I'm showing too much. Because the nice thing about that character in that book is that everyone thinks he's just a real hard-ass kind of bully. Certainly all the Catholics feel that way, don't they? And then he reveals that he's thinking things through quite pragmatically. And though his decisions are hard, he will try, first of all, to get people to follow a way that is least damaging. But inevitably, in the end, it's like either him for the chop or them, and they're the ones that go. I hope that answers it a bit.
Well, we'll get to see, because it starts in the new year, doesn't it, we think?
Yeah.
So let's come right down the front, down here, because that'll make everybody have to run with the microphones and everything. Sorry.
My name's Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How does your process change in terms of working on a character for theatre or for film? Because obviously with theatre you have such a longer rehearsal period and you can really shape a character through that. And with film it's obviously more instant.
Yeah. Did you all hear that question? How do I change my process for working on film or television with film and television compared to theatre? And particularly because in theatre you hopefully get a good rehearsal period, hopefully 5 or 6 weeks, maybe 3, but hopefully 5 or 6. On film, rarely.
Yeah.
I mean, Peter Kosminski was really the finest film director I've worked with. He will give you, we will read through the script, most of it. Did you and I read or not?
Oh, yeah, but also what struck me was, which is unheard of, is... we met and then we went into the castle and then we rehearsed with all the crew stood around for 45, 50 minutes on an 8-line scene on that first day, which is unheard of, because normally they just let the actors run the dialogue, you show it to the crew, you go away, you come back, and then they shoot it.
Yeah.
50 minutes to work out that relationship.
Yeah. It doesn't have to last as long, TV or film work, of course, so it's not, you don't have to sustain it over a long run, so it doesn't need as much fertilizer to some degree. If you think of it as a plant, it's just a little plant that's going to blossom and go that day. So longer rehearsal periods in the theater to some degree are enabling you to play a whole season like a football team. You're going to need to play this game for a long time, hopefully, if it's successful. And so you need a lot of different... You need a spectrum of performance rather than a narrow... With film, you're hunting. The terminology is literally, let's shoot it. It's interesting. It's like hunting. And they're hoping that you'll bring something wild that they can shoot. No one wants to just let the chicken or the cat out and then shoot the cat, do they? Or the lovely little terrier dog. Oh, yeah, let's shoot that. No, someone wants a fox or a wolf or a big snake or something. They want something wild and untamable that they're going to shoot that seems like they've caught life. The work is, it's slightly different, the work to prepare. But Peter is nice in that he'll let us first of all play the scene in the space, and then they'll decide how they're going to capture that scene so it can be shared with an audience. Most directors, they've imagined the shoot already and that you fit in and you don't have much time. I mean, in the case of Spielberg, he doesn't rehearse. I didn't meet him until the first day on the set. I met Tom Hanks and on Tom Hanks's invitation, and we read through the scenes in his apartment, but we just read them. I mean, that was nice that we'd broken the ice. But with Spielberg, you have the sense that he just expects everyone to do their job, that that's your craft and you'll turn up. And then he's very nice and appreciative and improvisational, actually. You need a lot more. I feel like I need a lot more of my improvisational skills in TV and film. You need to be very adaptable. And the main difference, though, I don't know that I prepare differently. You have to learn your lines separate from the other actors. That's a challenge. That you have to be careful about that, that you learn your lines in a flexible way, in a truthful way, but not in a way that's absolutely, this is the only way I can do it. Because you have to be just ready to meet the other actor and see what they're offering and respond. Hear what they're offering and feel it. And so you must learn and prepare, mustn't you, in a way that doesn't close you down, but prepares you to be open and comfortable when they're shooting you. In the theater, I don't tend to learn my lines before I go into rehearsals. I like to paraphrase and play with the other actor and make things up and gradually refine to getting the exact words. Because I find when I make things up, I'll get the essential nature of what. So I was in a play called La Bête once, which has a 30-minute monologue and rhyming couplets that I had to learn and play. And something I learned at RADA, actually, I united it. You probably do that too. You unit it. And I knew the first unit was me coming in, seeing David Hyde Pierce and the Hunchback, and thinking they're praying, because they were kneeling on the floor praying that I wouldn't come into the room. So that thinking they're religious people, so I need to impress them with my spirituality, my religious thing. And I knew there were about 10 lines that would do with that. So it was useful to know that that's. Now, first of all, I would just make that up to the best of my memory. And then as we did it more and more, it would get closer and closer to the text. It means, unfortunately, sometimes you come up with very wonderful ideas that don't fit the text and you have to kill them. you have to kill them. But it means also other ideas come in that do fit the text, which might not come if you just learnt it by rote, because they come from you trying to play, real trying. So I try and play from the beginning. Sometimes people will stop and come up, actors, with problems or things like that, and that's right and natural. But I don't feel like talking about it is going to help much.
Okay.
I don't feel like and that's helpful for film. You don't talk about it much. Well, you'll still encounter people who'll talk about the scene. Try and solve it talking about it. I think for me, a lot of that is nerves. I think we should just start playing. Just start to play and find out what's there by playing. But that's just my particular way. So I don't mind whether they're filming or not. I don't mind.
Good. Let's go to somebody else. Let's see if we can get a couple more in before we have to finish. Let's go right down the back there. Hand up, check shirt. Yes, you, the person who's looking round. Could you stand up for the exploitation purposes?
Hi. How's it going?
Hi.
You talk so much about just being so in the moment and all that uncertainty and being open to the other actors and everything, but do you ever have that moment of being on stage and just thinking about what you're going to have for dinner?
Yeah.
Or do the two, can the two coexist and how?
What's the last thing you said?
And can those two things, being in the moment and having some completely unrelated thought, can they coexist and how do you find that they do?
Oh, yes. The one thing I remember about you is we were...
Wait, we have to turn the cameras off for this thing.
Hello. I did four series of peep shows, so I know how to go down. We were executing Anne Boleyn at Dover Castle on a day when there was a day of national industrial action, and his main priority on that day was to get a placard made, which he was going to hold up in the middle of the scene, that said, "No more cuts." And you did it. You did it. You were absolutely just in the moment in the scene, and then absolutely obsessed with your Blue Peter stapling and your felt penning. And, you know, a leading actor might have said, "Could somebody make me a placard?" But no, you made it.
Yeah.
What do you do when your mind wanders away to what's for dinner then?
Trying to think about that. Those thoughts are not too... when my mind wanders away to what a crap actor I am, those thoughts are the difficult ones to deal with. You know, when you're just hearing all the time your own critical voices, or the critical voices you've read other people say about you, or teachers have said, or friends have said, or the ones you make up yourself. Those are distracting. But we are wandering away to what's for dinner. It doesn't happen to me quite so much. It used to happen to me when I was younger. I tend to be quite curious and instant. I don't think you can repress things like that. I remember when I've learned to meditate, there was some good talking about, you know, trying to stop your mind in all its whirling thinking. Trying to repress it is like trying to hold a log under water. It's just going to come back up again. And the Buddhists talk about moving through thoughts like that, rather than trying to repress or deny them, just actually going through them, as if you're pushing doors open, that there's a doorway in the middle of a thought about what am I having for dinner, and what's behind that, or what's inside that. So I'll tend to just go through it, maybe, to something else. I mean, obviously it suggests I'm not really connected to what my character needs. So it's not necessarily a very good thing, but mind you, just playing doggedly objectives can also be rather flat. And so having a backspace, I think having a backspace that's more fertile and may include thoughts like what am I having for dinner? Private thoughts like that seems to be part of people's life and nature. So I'm not sure it's a bad thing on the stage to have a mind that has lots of mundane thoughts like that, as well as what you're doing and playing. Sometimes an event will happen in the day. I remember specifically at this moment when Tiananmen Square was going on, and there was that young man who stood in front of the tank. The Chimerica play was all about it. This was back in the 80s, and I was playing Hamlet at the time. Now, Noel Coward, I think, famously said, you know, you should leave all that stuff outside the theater and just come in, and, you know, nothing of that should invade. But I turned to the audience at the Barbican Theater as Hamlet and said, the time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right. It's one of the early moments when the character turns to the audience and speaks with them. And when I turned, the auditorium had these lights along the balcony, and it suddenly looked like a tank. And the thought came in, nothing to do with Hamlet, of that young man standing in front of the tank. But it gave the line so much meaning. The time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right. That young man might have thought that, standing in front of that tank. As Chimerica said, maybe he was just trying to walk home with some shopping or something, and there he was, an image that will go down in history. So if you repress the thoughts about dinner time, will you also repress those wonderful thoughts coming in? Do you see what I mean? Anything where you're tempted to repress, I think needs consideration. I don't think it's necessarily helpful for us as artists. but to find ways of making all this fuel and all this stuff that goes on in our individual heads, how to channel that into what's happening, into the present moment. So that includes some dross, I would think, rather than a Puritan approach to it. And I think in a way that's helpful when you're on a film set. You can either try and close out all the technicians and everything that's going, or you just swallow it all. Then it's all part of the reality of my character. So nothing's wrong. I think that's an attitude that I've come to more and more, particularly in live theater, of preparing myself before going on stage, that nothing that happens between now and the end will be wrong. Nothing the audience does will be wrong. That's a very hard one when they don't laugh at your jokes. That's very hard. But you have to rein in as you become better at acting and can control an audience, can put them that way and then pull them back that way, that you don't become fascistic about it, that you don't become it's a bad audience because they didn't behave like my favorite audience. But because then you're closing out the moment, then you're closing out the present. So to be really open to the present and to what's coming in and still doing your job seems an ideal way. Paul.
Mark.
We haven't run out of time.
We have.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. I answer such long-windedly.
No. It has been an absolute joy. So thank you very much for your time. And I have to thank you for all the games. You have to go out and find about a game called Puckett, which he's mad about, which is wooden bands, rubber bands and wooden discs. But above all, you have to tune into Wolf Hall in the new year, because I think you'll see something quite brilliant. Would you join me in thanking the fantastic Mark Ryan? Thank you.